Single-handed, she had raised Shaza from infancy, when Shaza's father had been killed in action in France before his birth. Alone in the desert, she had discovered the first diamond that had led to the establishment of the fabulous Hani mine. For 30 years, she had run the mine and built up the sprawling financial empire that was to become Courtney Enterprises. Even though the chairmanship had passed to Shaza and then to her grandson, Gary Courtney, Santon still regularly took her seat on the board. Every word she uttered from that seat, every thought she expressed, was received with the utmost attention and respect. Every member of the family, from Shaza himself to Gary's brood of her great-grandchildren, aged between 4 years and a few months, stood in total awe of Santon Courtney. She was the only one who could give orders to Bella Courtney and have them obeyed without argument or question. She stood bareheaded in the bright sunshine of a golden day of Cape Spring, with the pedigree bitch squatting beside her, and the sunlight sparkled on her hair. Her hair was one of her finer points, dense and thick, and curling still, cut into a short cap, the colour of gunmetal touched with bright inlays of pure platinum. She held her chin high, and the set of her head alert. The years had not eroded her beauty, but had transformed it into a dignified serenity. Time may have withered that flawless skin, but had been unable to affect the strong line of her jaw, the proud cheekbones, and the high, intelligent forehead. Nor had it dimmed those dark eyes, eyes that could one moment reflect the ferocity of a cruel predator, and the next moment shine with humour and wisdom. "One hell of a lady," Shaza thought. "Just look at her, as hungry to win as she was 50 years ago." One of the judges blew a single sharp blast on his whistle, and Bunty Charles's shoulders slumped with disappointment. Amber Joy had failed and was being recalled. Bunty Charles reinforced the recall with a blast on his own whistle and a brusque hand signal. Amber Joy came in obediently to the bank and lunged up out of the water. He shook himself, throwing a crystal curtain of water droplets into the sunlight, and then, to the horror of his owner and the amusement of the spectators, lifted one leg and gave the nearest clump of reeds a contemptuous squirt, succinct expression of Amber Joy's opinion of the duck, the dam, and the judges. Such an unbridled display, while under judges' orders, was considered very poor form, and would certainly attract penalty points. However, Amber Joy was the picture of nonchalance, as he trotted back to his owner, lolling his tongue and wagging his sodden tail. At this stage, Dandy Lass was in a turmoil of eagerness. She was shivering wildly, rolling her eyes like a berserker. She knew she would be called next, and the effort of keeping her backside pressed to the ground and maintaining her seat was destroying her from within. Without looking down at her, Santon exerted all her powers of telepathic communication to hold the bitch under control. The judges were sadistically relishing the delay, making a pretense of consulting each other and writing up their notes, but in reality testing Dandy Lass to the outside limit of her endurance. If she broke now, she would be instantly eliminated. A whine or a bark would penalise her cruelly. "Bastards," Santon thought bitterly. "I hate every last man-jack of you. Let my darling go. Let her go." A faint choking whine escaped through Dandy's lips, a sound as though a bullfrog was being attacked by a swarm of bees under a blanket, and without seeming to move, Santon extended her forefinger down the side seam of her Chanel slacks, and Dandy suppressed her next utterance. The senior judge looked up from his notebook. "Thank you, number 3, he called across the water, and Santon said sharply, "Fetch!" And Dandy Lass went away like a golden javelin launched from the sling. As she came to the water, she folded her forelegs under her chest and went out from the bank in a stylish leap, like a thoroughbred steeplechaser, and hit the water 3 paces out, clear of the weeds. She came up swimming, and Santon's chest swelled with pride, only a true champion committed to water with such dash. Dandy Lass swam like an otter, snaking through the water, leaving a broad V of ripples across the surface. Then the swelling in Santon's chest turned to a cold weight of dread, as she realized that Dandy was making the same mistake as Amber Joy. Perhaps the long delay had unsighted her, but she was veering slightly across the wind and the current, up into the blind spot where the scent would be carried away from her. For an instant, Santon considered forfeiting points by redirecting her bitch. If Dandy found, even with assistance, she would still have wiped Amberjoy's eye, but they needed every single point if they were to win, and Santon could already taste the sweetness of victory on the back of her tongue. She stood motionless, her whistle dangling on the loop around her neck. Dandylass judged the length of the retrieve to within feet, and she circled once on the edge of the far reed bank, but she was still too high by 3 yards. Where Amberjoy had ploughed on, getting even further from the bird, Dandylass stopped and, treading water, looked back to where Santon stood on the far bank. Deliberately, Santon thrust her left hand into the hip pocket of her slacks. Not even the strictest judge, with the eyes of an eagle, could have construed that tiny movement as a signal. But Shaza picked it up. "Ha! The old girl hasn't changed," he shook his head, grinning. "Anything to win, any weapon in the arsenal, and the only sin is being caught out." In the water, Dandylass immediately turned left, down current, paddling hard, and 2 seconds later her nose went up as she acknowledged scent. She made one more circle, with the scent of the blood rich and hot in her nostrils, as she placed the fallen mallard. Then she ducked her head into the cold brown water. A roar of approval went up from the bank, and she lifted her head again, streaming water, ears flat against her skull, but the carcass of the mallard held in her jaws. She left an arrowhead of ripples behind her as she headed back to the bank, the bird held neatly, wings folded, keeping it high to avoid drag through the water. As her feet touched bottom, Dandylass flew up the bank. She did not even pause to shake herself. Not wasting a second, she went in to make her delivery. As she dropped to sit in front of her mistress, Shaza felt a choke in his throat, and his vision misted over. It was beautiful, he thought, to see that kind of rapport between a woman and a dog. Santon took the caress from Dandy's mouth, and the iridescent patches in the wings burnt like sapphires in the sunlight. She handed it to the judge, and he examined it carefully, parting the feathers to check for teeth marks, for any sign of hard mouthing, and Santon held her breath until the judge looked up again and nodded. "Thank you, number 3." Not only had Santon Courtney Malcolm-S provided the venue for the trials, but she was in addition the hostess for the prize-giving ceremony. The candy-stripe marquee tent, able to accommodate 500 guests, was set up on the main polo field of the estate, and from Feltefrieden's kitchens had come the gargantuan array of fine foods. The rock lobster had been caught by the fishing boats of Courtney Fishing and Canning Company at Lambert's Bay. The turkey had been raised on Feltefrieden. The succulent Karoo lamb came from Dragon's Fountain, the Courtney sheep station on the Candiboo plains of the Karoo. And the wines were from the vineyards that began at the edge of the polo field outside the marquee tent. The Prime Minister, John Forster, had agreed to present the prizes. This was the fruit of Santon's machinations over the years, a less than subtle hint to the world that the Courtneys were no longer a spent political force, that the days of their eclipse were ending. Shaza Courtney had been a member of the faction within the Favut cabinet that had opposed John Forster's elevation to the premiership, and in consequence he had been sent into political exile. But over the years that he had been in London, Santon had laboured with all her finesse and skill within the party to seek her son's rehabilitation. Of course, the fact that Shaza's term in London had been such an unequivocal triumph had reinforced her efforts. However, much of the credit for the Arms Corps appointment redounded directly to Santon's tireless lobbying, her refusal to accept defeat, and the blatant wielding of all her political and financial influence in her son's favour. She would see to it that John Forster's presence on the Feltefrieden estate heralded a new golden era for the Courtneys. His round red face was the rising sun of their hopes and aspirations, Santon thought comfortably, as she looked around the crowded marquee. They were all gathered here at Feltefrieden once again, all the power brokers and the power wielders, although none of them had ever been so foolish or so reckless as to give Santon Courtney Malcolm-S direct offence or to write her off completely. There had been a period of cooling off while Shaza had been serving his term in London. Some had been cooler than others, Santan reflected, with a steely glint in her eye, as she picked them out amongst the crowd. And she would remember them.
Now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer, she thought with deep satisfaction. And almost as if to echo her sentiment, the chairman of the South African Kennel Union rose to his feet and called for silence from the dais at the far end of the marquee.
After welcoming the Prime Minister and spending a few minutes discussing the field trial scene in general, the chairman began calling the prize winners to the stand, and the line of glistening silver trophies dwindled until only one remained in the centre of the green baize-covered table. But it was the tallest and most ornate of them all, with a statuette of a gun dog on point surmounting the pinnacle. "We come at last to the champion dog of trial," the chairman beamed around the tent, until he picked out Santan standing at the back of the tent surrounded by her family. "And it gives me much pleasure to call to the champion's birth, for the first time, a lady who, in the few short years since she has taken to our sport, has brought to it so much energy and enthusiasm that her contribution equals and in many cases surpasses those who have spent a lifetime working with gun dogs. Ladies and gentlemen, I ask you to welcome Mrs. Santam Courtney Malcolm-S and Dandy Lass of Veldtevreden." Isabella had been waiting outside the tent with Dandy Lass on leash, and now she came in with her, and while the crowd applauded, Isabella handed the dog over to her grandmother. Dandy Lass wore a fitted blanket in daffodil yellow, and Santan's racing colours, and with the Courtney insignia, a stylized silver diamond embroidered in one corner. She fell in beside her mistress, healing perfectly, as Santan started up towards the dais. The crowd laughed and applauded. Woman and dog made an elegant pair of thoroughbreds, and Dandy Lass grinned and lolled her tongue and wagged her tail at the fun of it. On the dais, Dandy Lass curtsied politely in front of the Prime Minister, and at a word from Santan offered him her right paw. The crowd loved it when John Forster stooped to shake the proffered paw. As he handed Santan the enormous silver trophy, the Prime Minister smiled at her. For a man with such a formidable reputation for ruthless strength and granite resolve, his smile was boyishly infectious, and his blue eyes twinkled. As he shook Santan's hand, he leant a little closer, so that she alone could hear his words.
"Don't you and your family find the unbroken success in everything you do become monotonous, Santan?" he asked.
They had come to first-name terms only in the last year or so.
"We try to be brave about enduring it, Uncle John," she assured him gravely.
The Prime Minister made a short and uncontroversial speech of congratulation and then circulated around the marquee with the alacrity of an adroit political gamesman. Smiling and shaking hands and passing on, he reached the end of the tent where Santan was holding court.
"Once again, my congratulations, Santan. I wish I could stay longer to help you celebrate your famous victory."
He glanced at his wristwatch.
"You have been generous with your time," Santan agreed. "But before you leave, may I introduce the only one of my grandchildren whom you have not met?"
She beckoned to Isabella, who was hovering close by. "Isabella has been in London, serving as hostess to Shaza during his term at South Africa House."